But there is a means. Krishna himself appeared in a dungeon. The dungeon in the prison of Kamsa to free his devotees when shackled there. As a testimony to what he'll do for us. When we show the slightest inclination to Krishna Katha by some humility and some eagerness, Krishna, who lives in that Katha, we're associating with his pastimes through the process of hearing. There's no difference. The process of Krishna consciousness is absolute. Everything about Krishna's, his pastimes are absolute. You're participating, you're entering those pastimes by the process of hearing. And Krishna, to help us, takes upon himself the cleansing process. How can Krishna, the most pure, enter into the deepest darkness of the rebellious jiva's hearts? Because he's the most humble. He's the most merciful. And when we show the slightest inclination to love him, he shows his infinite inclination to love us and reciprocate unlimitedly our slightest eagerness and humility in approaching him. So in this chapter, you see a little bit of the larger picture. What is the larger picture in this little episode of the romance, and when Diti was so plagued with lusty desires that she implored her husband for union, but it was the wrong time and it was the wrong motive, and they got these two demon sons, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, and they were delivered by the lords in the form of Nrisimha and Varaha. And Diti was thinking, that rascal Indra, he made Krishna violate his promise to be impartial, and he killed my son, so Indra needs to be killed. So she pleased her husband with such apparent loving service. And he said, oh, I'm so pleased by your service. I'll give you whatever you want, a son to kill Indra. And Kashyap said, oh, no. Now we're all going to be implicated. What to do? He turned to Krishna. The process of devotion. If you fulfill this vow, 1 year strictly worshiping Krishna by this Vaishnava etiquette, all your desires will be fulfilled. How were her desires fulfilled? Toward the end of the year, she fell asleep because she was so exhausted from all the tapasya. Indra entered her womb, and with his thunderbolt, that shining embryo who was becoming so purified by his mother's tapasya and service, shining, brilliant, like gold, Indra hacked it into 7 pieces. But then the embryo became 7. And Indra cut each one into 7 pieces. There was 49, more brilliant, more effulgent, more of them. And they began pleading with Indra, we're your brothers. Why are you killing us? And then he realized that Diti wasn't going to get a son who was going to kill him. She got 49 sons who were his servants, his brothers, his friends. And then she woke up and found that she wanted the one son. She got 49. She wanted one to kill Indra, but she was so satisfied in finding that her 49 sons were the best of friends with Indra. And then they all went to heaven. And it was so wonderful that that's how this whole chapter begins. And Maharaj Parikshit heard from Shukadeva Goswami that Diti, who generally gives birth to demons, gave birth to 49 demigods. How? What happened? He knew it was something about Krishna. He was too wonderful to be anything. And he was eager to hear. And Shukadeva was eager. But really, what is it? It's a lesson in how when he gets so, the false ego is so insidious. It'll do anything to be the center. Even if my suffering and my anguish and my ordeals keeps me in the center, then bring them on. And then, why are you suffering? Just let it go. But letting it go means letting Krishna, or letting Guru, put it forth. Because, you know, what does the Vaishnava do? He doesn't just come and soothe away the pain. He deepens it. Because pain deepened can be pain shared. And pain shared is pain redeemed. And he also, of course, Vaishnavas are tricky. Prabhupada said, just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. He didn't tell us, yes, that came later. How Krishna, you know, reciprocate. Krishna's tricky. It's a good thing he's tricky. We worship a thief. Why? Because we're so attached to our sufferings and our false ego that it would take the best thief to relieve us. But what does he do? And what does the guru? He takes our own little strides of suffering and pain and he deepens it. We didn't want that. That wasn't part of our initial agreement and vow. But Krishna's tricky. Because pain deepened can be pain shared. Everybody in this world is suffering. Don't get wrapped up in your own, the conditioned soul will become, he'll make an indulgence of his own suffering. Then why am I suffering? Why am I so indulging in it? So the guru, he deepens it because he allows you to actually look at what's in the depths of your heart. Oh no. But it's every conditioned soul. And then he takes our own fragmented stories of suffering and pain and lifts it into a larger story and context of suffering and pain. The whole material world is just an endless flow of suffering and pain. That's why the oceans are made of salt water. It's the tears of the anguish of the conditioned souls that fills the oceans. So how do you get so stuck up in your own little story? Look at the world. What are you going to do? What does Krishna want? That we distribute his mercy. And then, if you look at the larger picture, what is going on here? When Lord Nrisimhadeva appeared and killed Hiranyakashipu, he was roaring so furiously. And he was shaking his head, and his mane was cutting the clouds to pieces, throwing airplanes in orbit, or out of orbit, whatever. And Brahma and Shiva, they were terrified. They wanted to offer prayers to satisfy him and pacify him. They were afraid to go anywhere near him. They asked Lakshmi, you do it. I've never seen a form like this. I'm not going anywhere near him. And what to do? So Prahlad, in this childlike, simple, innocent form, came before the Lord and fell down and offered his prayers. I'm not afraid of your blood-soaked mane and the garland of intestines from my dear father, which are adorning your holy form. And I'm not afraid of those nails and teeth soaked with blood, because I know who you are. And then the Lord stopped roaring, and that lion just began purring. He took him in his lap. Because what's all that roaring? It's his protection for the surrendered souls, his own children. And then everybody came and offered their prayers. Fine, it was to provide. But what is, anyway, not to get off on this tangent, because the larger picture is, this wasn't really all about killing Hiranyakashipu. It was really, to really appreciate, just go back to the fifth canto. Residence of Hari. Hari Varsha offering their prayers. Headed by Prahlad. And everyone in that varsha joining him in his prayers, the Vaishnava prayer, let there be peace and harmony throughout the world. And let everyone's envy become pacified by practicing devotional service. Because only that, by the potency of bhakti, will they ever think about each other's welfare. Let us all together engaged in service to the supreme transcendence, and always remain absorbed in loving thoughts of Him. My Lord, we pray that we may never fall into the prison of material attachment with all its bondage, but may your nails and teeth like thunderbolts destroy our demon-like desires to exploit and control and enjoy in this world, and free us from our own internal demons so that we can be free to love, free to serve, free to take shelter at your lotus feet. That was the prayer that really inspired the appearance of Lord Nrisimhadev. It wasn't the demon here on the Kashyapu and the fear of the demigod. That was part of it. That was secondary. Just as a secondary effect of Diti's vow was her she was blessed by the fulfillment of the desire way beyond her initial inspiration. She wanted a son. She got 49 who were beautiful, who were effulgent, who befriended Indra. And that made her happy beyond what her envious desires initially intended and contemplated. So her, by a secondary aspect of her vow, her desires the fulfillment of her desires excelled the desire that she could have even conceived. That was just the secondary aspect of her vow, her service as instructed by her husband. The real fulfillment is that Diti, who was famous as the mother of the demons, became the grandmother of Prahlad Maharaj. And Lord Nrisimhadev told him, and he implored the Lord, please forgive my father. He said, not only your father, 21 generations will be delivered. So, if we really want to do, as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati told Srila Prabhupada, if you want to do good to yourself and to others, then share this message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Preach, distribute Krishna's mercy. Because as Krishna himself says, there is no one so dear, nor will there ever be anyone so dear, as he who shares this message, this holy discourse, Krishna and Arjuna, because it is filled with Krishna Katha, Krishna's holy name, which is the touchstone which fulfills all the deepest desires and yearnings of our hearts. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions? Louder, please. Yes. Well, Krishna says, those who consider themselves to be my devotees are not devotees. Those who consider themselves servants of the servants of the servants are the devotees of my heart. So it's best that we not think of ourselves as devotees. We should think of ourselves and one another as aspiring servants of the servants of the servant. Aspiring servant of the servant of the servant means there may be traces of anarthas left. And understanding the process of bhakti means that when you initially take up the process and invite, implore Krishna to come within your heart, the fight begins. Because humility also means truth, acknowledging the truth that we've come to this material world. We've taken birth here because of our envy of Krishna. From that root of envy, with its manifestation of false ego, Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha, Dantavaka, Shishupal, Ravana, Kumbhakarna, are not big world demons of other ages. They're the personification of the Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Madhavatsarya, which are in the hearts of all of us. And as long as you're surrendered to Kama, Krodha, Lobha, Moha, Madhavatsarya, it'll pretty much leave you alone. And it'll seem so natural that you won't even know that it's there. You won't even so much see that it's there. But then, when you confront your false ego with, I don't want to be surrendered to them anymore. I want to be surrendered to Krishna and his representatives, Guru and Sadhus and Shastra and the Vaishnavas. Then the false ego rises up like this multi-headed monster from the depths of the darkness of our heart, as if it's going to devour you. Kaliya, we've just been discussing lately, is a wonderful visualization for this process of chanting Hare Krishna. But Kaliya is not alone. He's assisted in his service to Kamsa with, you know, all these demons that are always attacking Braj. They're within us all. These are not some historical figures to study from the past. They're archetypes of elements that are within all of us. And when we take up the process of service to Krishna, Krishna brings them out because he wants them to be gone. And when they come out and you see them, it's not always pleasing or encouraging. Unless you know what's really going on. It's that Krishna's driving them out. So we don't see what's in the heart. Man sees what's on the outside. Krishna sees the heart. And Krishna from within the heart drives them out. See, he won't live with them. He drives them out. And then when they begin manifesting themselves in our outward dealings, it may not be very nice. You have to understand what's going on. Of course, another thing that can be going on is that this is the age of color, which means hypocrisy. And hypocrisy is not something that can be compartmentalized into certain aspects of our life, like I'll be hypocritical in the way that I dress, but I won't be hypocritical in the way I interact. No. Hypocrisy pervades all aspects of existence in the Kali Yuga. And it also tries to infiltrate the assembly of Vaishnavas. What to do? In the age of quarrel and hypocrisy, there's only one way. There is no other way, no other way, no other way than the chanting of the holy name, chanting of the holy name, chanting of the holy name. So, you know, we like to be in good association where everyone's kind and loving and compassionate and sweet. But sometimes Krishna sends somebody who just brings out the worst in us. Somebody who's so angry that they make us angry. Wonderful Krishna. If someone comes and is just so angry that he brings out your own anger, you should thank Krishna that here's a teacher to show me where the areas where I need to work. Because, you know, we have so many personalities in the Srimad Bhagavatam, like, you know, we discussed previously, you know, King Yadu and the Avadhut Brahman, you know, how are you someone like, well, I've, you know, 24 major gurus. But when you actually take to heart the words of the guru, you see that everyone and everything is there to instruct you, if you have the eyes to see and the ears to hear. So someone comes along who, see if I'm learning the terminology, they press your buttons, right? Means they program you to be like them. They're angry, so you get angry. You don't have to get angry, because what is anger? An acronym says it's a nasty getting even response. But you don't have to try to get even. You don't have to. You have a choice. If somebody gets angry at you and you get angry back, what have you done? You've just affirmed, yeah, it's worth getting angry about. But what is it really tell about the person's heart. What it really says is they're hurting. And why are they hurting? They think that Krishna doesn't love them. And if they don't feel like they're loved by Krishna, they can't be loving. So they're upset, they're hurting, and they respond with anger. What is that? That's a call to love. They need a demonstration of Krishna's love. We have that option too. You can get angry and confirm that, yeah, life is bad. Where is Krishna's love? Just get angry. Krishna doesn't love us. And then if you get angry and you push your buttons and you respond to the lower modes, you just affirm, yeah, it is lousy. And then you get all caught up in your own little fears and your own little hurts and your own cynicisms and criticisms, and life looks terrible. But you have an option. If someone comes and tries to interact with you in the lower modes of passion and ignorance, you don't have to perpetuate the karma. You have the free will to cancel it then and there by a higher expression of love and compassion in yourself. And it's the person, partly the own person's own free will and depth of conditioning, how they're going to respond, but at least you've done your part. And chosen that yourself, you don't want to perpetuate the interactions of the lower modes, but you want to bring something higher in the form of the compassion of Guru and Krishna into the world. So it may be any of these things, but we always have the free will to respond lovingly anyway. And to try to see the best, even if it's not the most obvious thing in the world, it'll help to bring it out and bring it about. Anything else?
Sometimes someone comes along and will make us angry, or will do something that really, really hurts us. The pain can be just so deep that, you know, you're just so wrapped up in it. It's very hard to see, like, the bigger picture. You know, when you're just, like, hurting so much, how can you, like, get over that?
Pain shared is pain healed. Rupa Goswami has given us 6 major categories of loving exchange. Revealing the mind and heart in confidence. Doesn't mean you go reveal your mind and heart to anyone, because there's different levels of violence. We can violate others' existence by killing. We can violate the peace by suspicious thoughts. We can violate relationships by breaking confidentiality. Confidentiality fosters confidence. So, if you're hurting so much that it's becoming like an obsession, you have to reach out and share that. And when you do, you usually find out that the other person is experiencing similar conditions. And in the sharing, because Srila Rupa Goswami has given us 6 major forms of loving exchange. The loving exchange is the medium by which Krishna comes and soothes our heart with nectar, the nectar of His holy name, the nectar of His pastimes, the nectar of the relationships which brings these pastimes to life. So, yes, it's a very important reality that we're not that strong, that we can always endure the pain that we experience. Yes, we can endure it alone. But in relationships, and part of the relationship is you find out, when you confide in another, I'm really hurting, you find out the other person is too. You didn't suspect that, you thought it was all you. And you find out, it's not just me, it's everyone. And what does that do? It usually awakens a feeling of compassion, a sense of another's well-being, a concern for another's pain, And that takes the center off yourself. You know, if you don't have that kind of sharing, if you don't have that kind of relationships, then yes, you do tend to get, you know, consumed in your own thoughts and your own pain and your own ordeals. But when you share, and then the burden's not all on you. And it's no longer a burden when it's shared. Then it's a matter of caring relationships. And that brings in the divine element, which is healing, which is redemptive. And as I said, we'll place that pain, it won't make it just go away. It'll place it in a larger picture of a suffering world where there's a seed of hope planted in the form of the Holy Name, which is the means by which Krishna takes root in our hearts and nourishes the Bhaktilata Bija to find the ultimate shelter for which it's yearning. So there's all these things can be seen as a teacher guiding you where to turn, where to reach out, where to touch and be touched. So the trick in dealing with the mind is don't let the mind be your master. You know, people, you hear so often, oh, I have so much trouble with my mind. You know, it's like to get rid of it, make it go to sleep or whatever. But, you know, it's there. But what's it really doing? It's just looking for pleasure. And if it doesn't find it, it gets frustrated. Well, the trick is don't let your mind be your master. Train it to be your servant. It's telling you, you're a pleasure-seeking living entity. We all are. It's not to be found in this world, pleasure. It's not to be found in sense objects. It's to be found in service. And then that pain, like everything else, can be your teacher, can be your guide. It's where to turn, where to reach out, where to touch and be touched. So relationships is what takes the center off yourself and opens up sharing and caring, which is redemptive because it's an aspect of Krishna's compassion and love.
So if somebody is actually in the middle of expressing anger toward you, and if you don't feel anger back and you do want to express compassion or understanding or love, how can you do it in such a way the person doesn't then feel like you're being, a lot of times when you try to do that, they kind of respond in getting angrier.
I'll give an example. There was a very nice man who had a very nice wife, a very nice family, but at one point his daughter became very rebellious and she fell into bad association. Got involved in bad habits and bad intoxication, which so much altered her behavior that she was always being angry and resentful and rebellious, and it put the whole household into complete turmoil. And they were trying everything, nothing, it just seemed to be getting worse and worse and worse until the husband just didn't know what to do. And then his daughter said, I just need a hug. And then he hugged her and then realized that they hadn't really been relating as they should have. Well, this is symbolic for reaching out and trying to touch the person where it's needed. If you get angry, you just reinforce the whole conditioning. It's a natural response. Somebody gets angry, you defend and get angry back, and you just reinforce the whole conditioning. But even worse than that is you've affirmed. And what are we angry about? We're angry because we're hurting. Why are we hurting? Because we don't really believe that Krishna loves us. If somebody gets angry, which is their way of, you know, venting that pain, and you do the same thing, you just confirm, yeah, it's true, Krishna doesn't love us. Krishna's not merciful. It's all rhetoric. But when you understand with your intelligence, that's the mind. And then by the intelligence, you guide, you know, you try to respond with higher modes. I don't want to get stuck in this. I want to And you, by a gesture of kindness, reaching out, compassion, understanding, acceptance, bring in the higher modes and affirm it. Yes, Krishna does love us. Krishna is merciful. Then that soothes that pain. You know, that pain doesn't want to be reinforced. It's the natural conditioning to do so. That's not what the heart wants. So we have to realize how much we're conditioned and try to elevate ourselves from the conditioning and the bondage of the lower modes to the higher modes. And understand, I'm not a computer to be programmed and have somebody pushing buttons. I just have to respond according to the modes. I'm conditioned to do that, but that's not really who and what I am. I'm really part and parcel of Krishna, servant of the servant. I'm supposed to respond. Give me another example. There's a story. I don't know if it's historical or allegorical, and it doesn't really matter because the lesson is the same either way. When, during the French Revolution, they were just going after royalty everywhere and chopping off their heads in the guillotine. This is like a contemporary example of what's the demon in Krishna Lila who personifies, you know, disloyal controversy. Anyway, contemporary history, you got the French Revolution. Disloyal controversy, intercommunal discord. The forest fire in Braj, it's the blazing conflagration, which symbolizes what happens when there's friction amongst the factions and jivas. It blazes out into a conflagration which destroys everything. That's why Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati predicted this real part, but there will be fire in the mountain, and there was. Anyway, contemporary history, got the French Revolution. And it all started the same way. You know, rumors, rumor mongering, fault finding, criticisms, culturing suspicion, which violates trust and destroys love. And finally, you know, the French Revolution was just following in the footsteps of the blazing conflagration which threatened to devour all the Brijabasis. So they were just, you know, the revolutions were just going around cutting off the heads of all royalty when it burst out in this, you know. And then they found a prince, a young boy, who was born of royalty. Take him to the guillotine. And the child was terrified. Down with the prince. And then somebody said, no! If you chop off the head of a child, he'll go to heaven. And that's too good for royalty. Give him to Meg, the wicked witch, and she'll teach him all bad ways. And he'll go to hell. So, yeah, they like that. So they took him to Meg, the black witch, and she tried to teach him bad words, and bad relationships, and bad indulgences. But he wouldn't do it. No, I'm a prince. I'm not meant for that kind of stuff. It's below my dignity. He just would not comply with Meg the Wicked Witch. Well, I don't know. You know, it may be historical, but whether it's allegorical, it teaches, you know, as aspiring Vaishnavas and Vaishnavas, it's below our dignity to, not that I have anything against computers, but to, you know, identify as a computer, that somebody comes and pushes your buttons and you have to respond. Because you're not a computer. You're a jiva. And jivas have free will, which computers, nothing against computers, but they don't have free will. And you see people they're trying to develop loving relationships with computers. You can't do it. They don't have free will. They may do whatever you want, but there's more to free will and love than that. So you got free will. You can choose to be a computer if you want. You can choose to be a Vaishnava. You're a Vaishnava if you want. It's all based on desire. And it takes practice. Sometimes you fail and you become a computer. But then you know when you're in your... by your intelligence, no, I'm not a computer. I have free will. I don't have to get programmed by this mode to act in that moded way. I have free will. I can respond with kindness because I'm supposed to be a representative of Guru and Gauranga. And you may fail a few times. You may succeed a few times. But what is conditioning? It's like making a rope. Do you ever make a rope? You know, you take one strand, and then you take another strand, and another, and then you get a string, and then you start braiding the different strings into a rope. And sometimes, like, you know, we used to have an elephant, so we'd take three ropes and braid them into what we called an elephant rope. And sometimes in breaking bulls and mules, they'd break an elephant rope, so you have to make it stronger. But a rope or a cable is just a bunch of little threads bound together until it becomes... Well, conditioning's like that. When you respond to any particular mode, it's like a thread. It's beginning to make that guna, that rope. And then we respond again, and there's two. Respond again, and there's three. Then when you get about nine, you got a strand. And then you keep... And then finally, it just becomes automatic. You are programmed by this mode to respond in this way. And therefore we have Bhagavad Gita to teach us what the different modes condition us, how the different modes condition us to respond, and then we train ourselves to immerse ourselves in higher modes, which will, you know, start creating that bond of a better kind of conditioning. And then when you get to the mode of goodness, that's next to Shuddhasattva, which is illuminating and freeing from bondage. And the real bondage we want is Krishna's love. We want to be bound and controlled to that mode, which expresses itself in humility, compassion, and service. And that's why we say, okay, we're practicing the process of devotional service, but we've had conditioning since time immemorial, so we make mistakes and we fall down sometimes. Because Shakyamuni, we see in this chapter, he knew there's going to be mistakes, there's going to be problems. The mistakes and problems are temporary manifestations of conditioned nature. The process of devotional service is eternal. So the faults and anguish we face from our shortcomings in our stage of practice, that's temporary. The results, the goal is eternal. So our goal is to be bound slaves of Krishna's mercy and be conditioned to respond to any situation with that expression.
So what is the difference when you gave, like, there's two situations where a devotee is sincerely trying to be a devotee and these anarthas come up so that they can get purified. So what's the difference when
The first thing is, the difference is deception. If we perform in a way, in a certain way, for the purpose of deception, we won't make any progress. We are taught to interact and behave in a certain way, you know, with respect and etiquette, and we do that because that's the way we're trained. But then, you know, you're thinking, well, this person said this, and I'm supposed to say Jai Prabhu, but I feel like saying something else. So what should I do? Should I say Jai Prabhu, or should I say something else? Well, Guru has trained me to respond like this. Is that a facade? On one level it is, but on a deeper level, we're trained by Guru to respond in the way that the soul would. So if you're doing that, even though it's a little bit mechanical, and it feels hypocritical, on a deeper level, that is you. That is the way your soul would and should respond. So that behavior, which is dictated by Guru's instructions, may seem a little hypocritical or unnatural because we're conditioned to respond in a different way. But if you do it, if you behave that way, then you become conditioned to interacting on spiritual principles. And that becomes natural because it is your nature all along. But some, they learn the linguistics, they learn the culture, they learn the rituals because they want to deceive. They won't make advancement. How to deceive? How to determine if the motive is deception or purification? By their fruits you shall know them.
So Beauty was initially acting to deceive, and then her husband put her in a different mode to want to get. Did she want to get purified, or she still wanted to do the same thing?
Both. She wanted both. But when the process of bhakti and the process of material conditioning confront one another, bhakti is more powerful. As long as that's what we want. Because Krishna ultimately fulfills it. So she had both. She had conditioned desires as well as pure desires. So her husband engaged her in the process which would cultivate the higher desires. Which would, it's like, what's a good agricultural field? One which is free of weeds? What?
It has living organisms.
One which is full of bountiful grains or crops. They crowd out the weeds. You can't have a field that's just plain free of weeds. Something's going to grow there. So it's your choice what you're going to grow, what you're going to cultivate. If you don't cultivate anything, then the weeds take over. If you cultivate a rich, healthy crop, then the weeds don't have a chance. Actually, Srila Prabhupada used that analogy of a paddy field. He said the heart's like a paddy field. It's like an agricultural field. So he used the analogy of rice. Like the Bhakti Lata Bhita, rice grows underwater. And as long as the rice is underwater, it flourishes. If the paddy field becomes dry, then the weeds that are in the soil, they take over and crowd out the rice. So you got to keep your heart flooded with the nectar of devotion. And then the weeds can't, they're there, they're dormant in seed form, but they can't grow in the environment of that nectar, which is like the water is to the rice. But if the dike breaks, but you don't replenish it, and it gets dry, and then it starts to crack, and then it won't hold water even if you put it in. So it requires, you know, continually hearing the Bhagavatam and rendering service, all things that are troublesome to the heart are practically destroyed, and love and devotional service to the Lord, whose eulogies and prayers and hymns is established as an irrevocable fact. So it's a continuous process. You can't, you know, base your success or failure on just a few days of practice. But, you know, generally it's not one or the other. It's both. In the conditioned soul, it's both a sincere desire to be purified along with a little bit of desire to deceive. But there again, in relationships, you got a choice of which one you're going to cultivate. The higher one, the lower one. It's a lot, tremendously based on by your own interactions and your own responses. Therefore, you got to, you know, train and exercise the higher self, get control and dominance over the lower self. And conditioning works in a good way, too. Conditioned the higher modes and conditioned the transcendental modes. We're creatures of habit.
So then it's in perception. How, like, if someone's acting that way to you, you can choose to perceive them as being hypocritical and looking at it in that way as a fault, or you can perceive them that they're struggling.
And they're sincere and they're struggling.
Right.
And which is right and which is wrong. They're both right. But the one that's going to become reality is the one you focus on and the one you respond to. Because that's what you're, you know, the exchange is what gives life. So what are you exchanging with? You exchange with lower modes and lower desires? That's what you're making stronger. Or you're exchanging and interacting on the higher level, which brings out the best. That's what we need to do as aspiring devotees. And even if it's just like some tiny spark of goodness and a whole blazing fire of lust, well, if that's what you're focused on, that's what you interact with, that's what's going to take dominance in the long run. So patience has to accompany perseverance to bring about results.
Like Kasyapa, he could have criticized her.
Just imagine, in today's world, some, standard husband or wife, and the husband's so pleased by the wife's behavior, I will give you whatever you want. So, I want a child who can kill President Bush. There's a lot of husbands that would be delighted with that desire. But what is that going to do for anybody? He's going to get another demon. Maybe the greater lesser of two evils, but it's all evil anyway, so why go there? Plenty of men would be delighted. Yeah, I'll go with that. What does that accomplish? Rotating about in lower modes of samsara. How about a son who can please Srila Prabhupada? Okay, well, there's a certain procedure that'll bring about that result. And that's what we want to choose. And ultimately, we talk about children. It's got a lot to do with your own consciousness, what you're cultivating in your own heart and giving birth to. We want to give birth to Krishna consciousness in our hearts. So we follow the etiquette. Achieve that goal. Thank you very much. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.
I'll be right back.